down?
No, I like to be on the line. Open the House Committee on Judiciary. Today is February 6th. First thing I'll announce, we're not going to work. We're going to sit over House Bill 4048, which is the wrongful death bill. There's a little bit of work to be done. We're also short of members. As you can see, the weather's had some effect on us. So we don't plan to vote on any bills today, but we are going to have hearings and try to get them all teed up to go. The first bill we'll have today is House Bill, public hearing on House Bill 4114. Mr. Taylor.
You said 4125 or 41?
I'm sorry. 4118. 4114 will be.
Mr. Kelso's bill, right?
Yes.
4125.
Reserve officers?
Yeah.
Yes.
4125 will open a public hearing on 4125. House Bill 4114 is set over, I think, till Monday.
So please. House Bill 4125 comes to you from Representative Gelsop. It includes reserve police officer within the aggravated murder statute when reserve officer is on duty. Penalty for aggravated murder is death, life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, or life imprisonment. Increases the penalty from 120 months to 140 months for a conviction of attempted aggravated murder, a conspiracy to convict aggravated murder against a police officer or a reserve officer. Mr. Chairman, of the committee, what this bill basically does is treat a reserve officer for the purposes of these statutes the same as a regular police officer.
And I heard you say it increases the penalty from 120 to
140.
But it's 240. It is 240.
Yeah.
It just was a misspeak.
Okay.
So it doubles the penalty from 10 to 20 years. Okay.
I do. Okay.
Representative Gelser, please. You can.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from Corvallis and Philomath, which is in Benton County. Thank you for staying for the hearing today. I know that the weather is difficult, and I appreciate your making the time to be able to be here today, and I hope you all get home safely this evening. I'm pleased to bring you House Bill 4125. Several of you are co-sponsors, and I want to apologize, or I extend the apologies of Representative Sherry Springer, who's the chief co-sponsor of this bill. She did need to leave to get home through the weather. You have a letter from her, and I'm going to point some things out from her letter as well. I'm also pleased to have with me today Sergeant David Peterson, who is on my left, and Corporal Andrew Connolly, who is on my right. They were involved in the incident that led to my drafting of this bill. Quite simply, this bill looks at the minimum for attempted aggravated murder on an officer while the officer is in the line of duty. There is a significant disparity between the current mandatory minimum for attempted murder and the mandatory minimum for murder, even though the action is the same and the impact on the officer and the public safety is very significant. These two fine officers are going to tell you a little bit about an incident that occurred in Benton County about 2 years ago, and I think that you will see and agree that the impact of that event continues today and will continue for more than 10 years, which is currently the mandatory minimum. A couple of issues that I want to address about that piece of the bill. Some people have asked, why would the life of an officer be more valuable than the life of anyone else? Quite simply, it isn't. All lives are valued and all lives are equal. And that's why this bill is tailored very narrowly to talk about the attempted murder of an officer in the line of duty. When that assault takes place on an officer who is responding to an emergency, that crime is not just against that individual. It's not just against Sergeant Peterson. It is against the people of the community. It's against the public safety. Because if that officer can be knocked out, then that individual can continue the crime and continue to put those whom the officers came to rescue in danger. So that is why I believe that is significant. I want to point out it is very, very narrowly constructed to only be while in the line of duty. The second piece of the bill makes a clarification in the statute about who is included in the definition of a police officer. Right now, there is a lack of clarity, and reserve officers are not included. I don't believe that this makes any sense. If you look at it in terms of common sense, it makes no sense at all. For example, as I said, you're going to hear the story about North Albany, but if these two gentlemen and Officer Libke, who we heard about this morning, had all responded to that incident, and he had died, and either of these gentlemen had died, and the assailant had lived, it does not make sense to me that under our current law, the death of Officer Libke would be charged as a lesser crime and have a lesser penalty than for these two officers who would be wearing the same uniforms, responding to the same event, and be victim of the same type of a crime. It just doesn't pass the common sense test. I understand that people have concerns about the penalty that's related to that. I don't see this as a penalty question. It's a definition question. It's the same question that we answered this morning on the floor, where I believe Representative Barton stood up and talked about those scholarships. It's not about creating scholarships. It's not about whether we think the scholarships are the right thing to do. It's, does it make any common sense at all that we would take an officer that puts herself in the line of danger, that risks her life, at a different level of protection than an officer who has a different classification? Representative Springer wanted me to be sure to point out her strong support of that area of the bill. She was a deputy in Benton County, Representative Springer, and she shared with me a photo of her when she was, in fact, a reserve officer. I believe she looks younger today than she did then. She's fantastic, of course. But especially in rural areas, sometimes your reserve officers outnumber your non-reserve officers. It simply makes common sense, and I don't believe we should have a statute that suggests that their sacrifices, their efforts, or their skills are any less valuable than the other officers that are responding. I'll be happy to answer any questions after these two tell you a little bit more about their stories and how we happen to get here today. I would also mention that the Association of Oregon Counties has voted and is endorsing this bill as well.
Thank you. And just go ahead, whoever, and please remember to state your name for the record.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman Barker and members of the committee for having us today. My name is Andrew Connolly, and I'm a police officer with the City of Salem. I've been a police officer for about 19 years, starting my career in Arizona and then moving to Oregon about 14 years ago.
Chairman Barker, my name is David Peterson. I'm a sergeant with the Benton County Sheriff's Office, and I have been working there since 2006. And about 3 years prior to that, I actually was a reserve deputy where I volunteered my time.
And maybe you could go ahead and talk about the incident and what made you interested in this.
Sure. Well, on August 11th, 2012, my life, Corporal Connolly's lives, and many other lives were changed forever. To make a very long story short, we had received a call of a trespasser at a house in North Albany, and myself and several other deputies responded to that and located the car that this person was in. And we had a short pursuit, and the suspect crashed his car, and he fled into some brush. So we set up a perimeter, and we called for a neighboring canine, because our canine deputy was on vacation that weekend. And the Salem Police Department actually had a canine. And there were some unusual things that happened that night, and one of those was the Salem Police Department. And typically in law enforcement, if we have a canine that we go lend to a different agency or vice versa, we usually send maybe one canine officer and then maybe one other person. That's it. Well, they sent five. And we started a canine track. The Salem police officers went into the brush, and the suspect was probably 20 feet into the brush. He popped up, and I've had these situations before. We get in pursuit, and somebody runs in the brush, and we chase them with a canine, right? Usually, they want to run away from all the law enforcement. Well, this guy decided to run towards all the law enforcement officers and all the cars, which was a little unusual, and he got in between his car and my car, and he was heading towards all the other law enforcement cars. And so I left my car, and I got behind him and tried to use my taser because he had his hand near his waist. Man, he wasn't displaying a weapon at the time. And as soon as I tased him, he instantly turned around and fired three or four shots at me and heard him, saw him. He continued to fire other law enforcement officers. He struck Corporal Connolly once, and then Deputy Galler, a Benton County deputy, and myself were able to return fire to subdue him. At that point, I was shot three different times, once in my left shin, once in my left knee, and once in my abdomen just below my vest. I actually just found out about 2 months ago, I was actually almost shot a fourth time. Another bullet had struck the taser that I was holding, so it missed my hand by several inches. I'm very thankful for that. At that point, I was transported to the hospital, and I died right there on the hospital table. I had to be revived. The hospital ran out of blood. I lost so much blood. Actually, the state police had to run blood in their car's code from Portland. My wife, who's here today, during that time, another deputy went to our house, which was just about 2 miles away from where the incident happened, was able to grab her, and I think sometimes we're a little too efficient because she got to see me get wheeled from the emergency room to the operating room, and I was white as a sheet, and she actually had the thought that, oh, he's dead. After that first surgery that night, I was in an induced coma for 2 or 3 days. I was in intensive care for a week. I was in the hospital for about 3 weeks, and then had some complications, including a major infection. And then I was back in the ICU for another week, and then in the hospital for 2 more weeks. So all said and done, I was in the hospital for nearly 6 weeks. I endured intense physical therapy for 8 months. The physical scars that I have will last forever. I have major complications to my bladder and ureter and urinary system because of the many things that it did went through my bladder, and it also caused significant nerve damage. At the bottom of your spinal cord, your nerves kind of come out like that, and it nicked a couple nerves that went through there. So of the many things I had to deal with was incredible nerve pain in my toe. Of all things, for about a month. Every evening for about 6 hours, I would have, on a pain scale of about 8 on a 10, and it would last for usually most of the afternoon and evening, every single day, for about a month, and it just sort of went away. I also have, had, foot drop, which the nerve was deadened, so I couldn't lift my foot up to run. I couldn't, I had to wear an AFO, which assisted my foot to walk for many months. And at one point, I wasn't able. Well, the doctor said that I wasn't able to go back to work because of all the damage and all of the physical issues that I had. But luckily, I'm happy to say that I was able to get through all those enough to where I was cleared. So I've been back at work for just almost 3 months now. Is all. The point of all of this, describing all of my different injuries and everything, is that about a year after the incident, the suspect did survive, and he was didn't go to a trial. They offered him an open sentencing deal, and he was sentenced to just 10 years for everything that he did to me and my family and everybody else, and then just another 10 years for his attempted murder on Corporal Connolly. And I know that the penalty in Oregon is for a completed aggravated murder, of course, working in law enforcement. And I guess why I'm here today is it's very simply that to go from life to all the way down to 10 years for just, and the only reason that I survived is I had two SWAT medics just happened to be working that worked on me, and I happened to have a doctor that was on duty that was retired from the Army Reserves, who spent two tours in the front lines very recently working on what kind of surgeries. So I was very lucky in that, and basically it's only because of their skill that that crime went from a life or maybe even something different down to 10 years. And that's just simply wrong. You know, I don't know what else to say. It's just simply wrong that if somebody can get just 10 years for doing all that. And so I, that weekend after we had court, I went online and did my extensive Google research the best I could, and couldn't find a single incident anywhere in the entire country where somebody shot two police officers and the suspect survived and both of them survived, and the person wasn't sentenced to 20 years. I mean, I couldn't find one that was even close. The complications and the injuries that I have, I'm going to have to deal with for life. I have a blood clot in my leg that is there that will probably be there forever. And I have a certain risks that are involved with having a blood clot that are going to be with me forever. I have recurring bladder infections. About every 2 months I have a bladder infection, so I have to go get antibiotics and deal with all of that every 2 months. What makes law enforcement unique, and I think what makes this bill unique, is that the law enforcement, every single night, they choose to leave the safety of their homes to go out and try and defend everybody else. Like Representative Gelser said, their lives inherently aren't more valuable than anybody else's, but when somebody chooses to attack law enforcement, that suspect wasn't shooting at David. He doesn't know me, but he was shooting at law enforcement. And there isn't a bigger representative, I think, of the community and really the government in general in everybody's daily lives than law enforcement. So I would hope that the legislature would recognize that and recognize that that crime is very, very unique, and that the legislature should protect and defend those that protect and defend everybody else. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As I stated earlier, I've been in law enforcement for about 19 years. I've been involved in several traumatic incidents, different levels of uses of force. But the evening that Sergeant Peterson is referring to changed my life and my family's life dramatically. I'm very passionate about my work, as are all law enforcement officers, full-time and reserve, and they risk their safety to ensure the safety of others on a day-to-day basis. We walk up into people's yards in the dead of night, in the dark, in the rain, in the cold, to protect other people. We walk into dangerous situations or traffic stops not knowing anything about the driver when they believe that we know everything about the driver. And it's an inherent risk that we assume and that our families recognize, but there certainly needs to be some peace of mind and some added securities for our families in a tragic event, much like Sergeant Peterson and I experienced. That was the hardest phone call I've ever had to make to my wife. Shortly after I was shot, I've taken on or had two surgeries to repair a fractured tibia and a shattered fibula, and then I was in a boot, immobilized for 4 months, and then had to have a second surgery to re-break my ankle and repair a tendon. So the physical part of it is still continuing to heal. For my family, they're still struggling with the individual that shot us and trying to reconcile why somebody would shoot their dad. And having five children, none of them sleep well when I'm out on patrol recently, and I've only been back on the road now for about a month, so I get these continual texts through the evening to ensure that they're safe and that I'm safe. On the topic of the sentencing, it was a huge disappointment for the entire law enforcement profession in this state when the sentence was handed down, that there was a 10-year sentence for the injuries Sergeant Peterson sustained and the injuries that I sustained. That's the bare bones minimum that an individual could be sentenced to, and that's what the judge felt was necessary or felt was appropriate. I can tell you, talking on behalf of almost everybody that I've talked to since this incident that's in the law enforcement realm or has family in the law enforcement profession that was stunned by that sentence. They felt that it was not justice. I feel that it was not justice. The individual that shot us, he was not remorseful. He steadfast dug in his heels and said that he wasn't meaning to shoot Sergeant Peterson and myself. But when you fire a gun pointing at somebody and you fire a gun five times and you hit people 4 out of the 5 times, that by definition is intentional. I'm not sure of the members of the committee that own firearms, but that's one of the first cardinal rules of firearm safety is to know what you're shooting at and know that the damage that's going to be done if you're shooting at somebody, and it is absolutely intentional, which is what the statute requires for a conviction for attempt aggravated murder. I think the definition is very narrowly scoped to impact those people that choose to attack and assault police officers intentionally with the pure intention to kill them. In regard to adding the reserve officer to the definitions and including them in this bill, reserve officers are very unique. And on the budgetary side of things, I believe we're going to see more reserve officers fulfilling the role due to budget constraints and budget reductions in rural police departments and sheriff's offices. They rely heavily on reserve officers in several of the communities in this state, and to not afford them the same protection and the same accountability for people that try to harm them or do harm them intentionally is not fair. It's not fair to the reserve officers. It's not fair to our profession to say that a full-time officer is more valued than a full-time officer, or a full-time officer is more valued than a reserve officer. I have friends that have been reserve officers. That's where they started their law enforcement career at. And personally, those people are just as valuable to me as my family is. And they, again, should be afforded the same accountability and the same justice that a full-time officer is granted. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. I really appreciate your testimony. Bill Miller.
Chairman Barker and members of the committee, it's hard to follow. It's hard to follow the act the gentleman's here went through, because I've never been quite in that situation. But I'm a reserve deputy of Umatilla County, and I've been there 33 years. Prior to that, I was 12 years as a reserve here in Marion County, and a few years in California before I got the bright idea to move north. I'm representing today the Oregon Peace Officers Association, which has about 1,200 members, and the Oregon Association of Reserve Peace Officers, which we have about 100 members and that sort of thing, representing 20 to 30, around 30 agencies. I'm currently president of the ORPO, or Reserve Officers Association. There are about 1,300 reserves in the state of Oregon. That number varies quite often, but still that way. And they work both in small agencies and very large agencies. Portland Police Bureau now has around 30. My department, we have 15. I just lost 3 of them, one to retirement, one real job couldn't keep up with that, and one went full-time to the department. In the smaller agencies especially, where I live in Pendleton, hopefully I get there tonight, the reserves are their only backup or fallback when somebody has to go on vacation or gets hurt or that sort of thing. So they're the ones that come back out and cover for the officers. In our department, again, we only have 8 patrol deputies covering 3,200 square miles. And sometimes, usually there's only 2 on at a time. And if those are sick, which has happened, or some other issue has happened that several times, the only body to fill in those slots are reserves. We have 8 solo reserves in our department right now, and a total of 15. And they fill approximately a little over 5,000 hours a year in patrol and training. And a couple years ago when I figured out the stats, the solo reserves covered what would be 1 2/3 man out or man days of work within the county. So that's a tremendous asset to the county, and took that to commissioners. They were quite surprised. Reserves are unpaid volunteers, and a lot of the expense and obviously time goes to doing what they're doing, and there's no reason that they should be treated any differently than a regular. 2 years ago, we were here talking about getting all the ORSs straightened out with reserves being considered a peace officer, a police officer, and that was passed by you folks and the others, and appreciate it. There's several functions that we have in Pendleton. Some of you have heard of the Roundup. I haven't noticed you there, but that's fine. Come spend your money. We could use it. But in 2010, as an example, that was 100th year anniversary, and the town was full. We had about, they guesstimated, 85,000 people in town that were from Pendleton. And I managed the security at the Roundup itself and some other functions in the area that at night. And I had 75 people working for me. Those were the locals, but also from surrounding counties, Union, Morrow, the different cities. And a lot of those came in as reserves to help fulfill our needs and duties. And if we didn't have reserves, and if they don't get the same protection, somebody's going to be upset about it. Especially wives. The gentleman earlier talking about wives and the families, and that's an issue. There's been, and I had forgotten about this issue, but several years ago in Southern Oregon, there was an issue where an officer got shot with a shotgun, a reserve. In Madras in 2009, there was three officers shot at by two suspects, and suspects were charged with two aggravated murder charges. Attempted aggravated murder charges and one just murder charge because one of those officers was a reserve. And that's not right. As you can tell or see or talk, I've always wanted to line up 20 or 30 in here and you pick out the ones in reserve. And we can't get them all together, especially the reserves. They have real jobs.
Yeah.
We've been trying to get this through the system for 14 or longer years, depending on who you talk to. And it's something that should happen. I'm not a total proponent of the death penalty, the part of the aggravated murder statute. I know that's an issue here, or over here in this area. But it's the other sentencing that you just talked about. It's a bargaining chip for the DA to use to get the sentencing to be equal for the guy with the badge. When somebody shoots at you, they're shooting at the badge. And it says the state of Oregon on it. So that's really important. I get emotional because of the Lipke thing. I put on my first badge as a reserve a little over 50 years ago. And I've been a reserve. I've trained hundreds of them or helped train hundreds of them. And the loss of him was personal to me. I didn't know him, but it was personal.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and we really appreciate it. I think I speak for all citizens of Oregon, the time that's spent, volunteer time that's spent by reserve officers and reserve firefighters as well in this state. So thank you very much.
And, sir, thank you for driving over the pass, given the weather. It's not lost upon us.
You put a lot when I get home.
You invested a lot to be here today, so thank you.
Thank you. Gail Meyer, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. It's always difficult to be in this posture coming up behind testimony that we've just heard. I do want to publicly acknowledge the courage and the service of law enforcement officers everywhere, whether they be reserve or not. I have long figured out that I probably wouldn't want to do a traffic stop in Lake Oswego. There's just too much variability, and they deserve our respect. So my comments, I hope, will not be interpreted to be anything other than an indication of concerns from a different perspective, but definitely all officers deserve to be fairly and equally treated in the line of duty. The problem with the bill as we see it, I'm going to be addressing Section 3 of the bill, or Section 2 rather, which addresses the mandatory minimum, is that that's what the bill is saying. In no instance ever again, henceforth, will there ever be a scenario by which any person 16 years and older would ever deserve a sentence of less than 20 years. And we just The scenarios don't always look the same. This isn't a one-size-fits-all universe. Very frequently, attempted aggravated murder charges lodged against someone don't involve use of a deadly weapon, and they don't involve anyone getting injured. Very often, and you see this scenario arise frequently, it's someone behind the wheel of a car who's been blocked in and is attempting to evade and get the heck out of there, and somebody's got to jump out of the way. That will lodge a charge of attempted aggravated murder. And I pulled this out to my members, and I said, give me instances of these kind of charges, and what do they look like? And pretty much that was the majority of what came back, was the car, the guy trying to get away from the car. In one instance, there were two officers that came up to the individual in the car. One officer yanked the wheel, and the car started to retch in another direction. The other officer shot the defendant, so the defendant ended up with two bullet wounds with a different officer with their hand on the wheel, but the defendant was charged with attempted aggravated murder, to wit, trying to run over someone with a vehicle. So my point to the committee is this. These allegations can be made under factual scenarios that don't look like what happened in Benton County. Once they're lodged, and once they come out of the grand jury, on one piece of paper, on the indictment, virtually the district attorney has checkmate in their hand. They would now have, under this bill, a mandatory 20 years on the line, regardless of whether or not there were physical injury or deadly weapon used. So that's the pernicious effect of mandatory minimum sentences. It loads up the first party, the state. They can trump it. It's just checkmate from the gate. And so because we don't live in a one-size-fits-all universe, we espouse that mandatory minimums are not to be encouraged and not to be doubled. The truth be told, a judge has a lot of tools in a judge's toolbox to get above a mandatory minimum sentence. I spoke with the attorney who had defended the defendant, who represented the defendant in this particular sentencing proceedings. Had the allegations been phrased just slightly differently, had the district attorney alleged and proved aggravating circumstances, the judge would have had a lot more tools in the judge's toolkit. The judge could have doubled the guideline range and have gotten up to 180 months pretty easily. But they were not pled and they were not proved, and the defendant didn't plead to them. And so the judge, quite frankly, was more constrained than the judge would have been had the case come to the judge in a different posture. Usually in mandatory minimum instances, a judge has a ton of tools in the judge's toolbox to go up. But what happens with the mandatory minimum sentence is that a judge never has a tool in their toolbox to go down. Neither does the jury. Sometimes you get notes from a jury, please show the defense, please show the defendant leniency. That's happened. The judge has no tools to go down. So we believe that there's going to be another case of an attempted aggravated murder where someone's not going to deserve 20 years. And that's the effect of the bill. The effect of the bill is to say, never again will there ever be a factual scenario whereby anybody doesn't deserve a mandatory 20. We would disagree with that proposition, and we would ask the committee to not pass the bill.
I would just say I would be surprised in a scenario where somebody just jumped out of the way, even if they were charged with that they would ever be sentenced under that. It could possibly happen.
Chair Barker, the point of it is once it's lodged, it's on the table.
Yeah.
The defense has no room to move. I mean, it is almost virtually a checkmate move, because at that point, you're in a position of, do you accept the offer, do you reject the offer, but you're not filing your motions.
I understand.
You're not filing your motions. So you don't really have the ability to contest the strengths of the state's case, let alone the basis under which they obtained it. And so in our view, it takes the wheels of justice and it grinds them to a halt, because it unfairly empowers one party.
I understand that. I recall a case in Florida where person who was a parole violator was allowed to took the opportunity to use the car to knock somebody down, roll it right over them, and then drive over them again. And I would think a case like that is not like somebody just jumping out of the way, and cars can kill you, so it is.
Chair Barker, I think you're making the point that I am hoping to make, which is in the world of conduct that fits within the range of attempted aggravated murder, you have multiple case factors. Your situation and scenario is of a grievous injury. Someone's gotten run over by a car.
Twice.
Yes. That's bad. That's very bad. The point of it is this also applies to someone who is truly attempting to flee a scene. The instance that I referred to where the officer came in and yanked the wheel and the other officer hit the defendant, ultimately that case was referred over to the feds and the federal government picked up the prosecution. They didn't even choose to charge that. They alleged other conduct relating to a marijuana grow, but they chose not even to charge anything with respect to that whole encounter. The point is that once it is charged and it's got another grand jury, the game's over.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Myers, thank you for your testimony. As I see it, this bill is essentially two bills. There is the mandatory minimum component to which you have spoken. There's also what I will call reserve officer parity. I entirely understand that OCDLA does not, and indeed probably never will, support the mandatory minimum component of any bill. I gather from your silence, may I infer that you are at a minimum neutral regarding the reserve officer parity? Do you have any problem with that, Bart?
Thank you. Chair Barker, Representative Barton, thank you for the question. I think it would be very difficult for anyone to say that reserve officers are not as an equal to other officers arriving at a scene of a crime.
Yeah.
We do note that we're not just dealing with the attempted aggravated murder instances by that amendment in Section 1. Section 1 increases the pool of persons potentially subject to aggravated murder death penalty prosecutions. So from the standpoint of OCDLA, we're very reticent to support anything that would expand the pool of death-eligible prosecutions. Other side of that is we don't want to be heard to say that we think there's a difference between the life and safety of reserve officers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Meyer.
Thank you.
And because we are short of some members today, we're not going to move the bill today, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4125 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4037. Mr. Britt.
Okay. Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 4037 will grant sheriff's departments throughout the state authority to delegate the initial transfer of youth offenders to the county juvenile to the county juvenile departments or the Oregon Youth Authority. This will result in directly transferring youth offenders to the Oregon Youth Authority without the need to first process them through adult correctional facilities.
Thank you. And do we have a fiscal report on this yet?
We do not have a fiscal report yet. That was a mistake. It's a minimal impact in terms of fiscal, and there's no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you.
Chair,
Representative Barton.
Thank you. Although my name is on top of the bill, and this is one of my two priorities for this session, I'm sitting up here and not down there because these are the people who really did the work. I appreciate everybody coming together on a collaborative process as we continue to try to separate the juvenile from adult populations. Really appreciate that. There's a lot to work through, and I want to thank each and every one of you.
Sure. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Shannon White. I'm the Deputy Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. We are a statewide membership organization celebrating our 15th year this year, and we advocate for policies that support both victims of crime and people convicted of crime to rebuild their lives after crime and violence. We are here today in support of House Bill 4037, which is fairly straightforward in what it does. Technically, it just allows the sheriff to delegate, the sheriffs to delegate their authority to transport youth to either or both the Oregon Youth Authority or the local juvenile department. That's what the bill does. The intent of that change is so that these juvenile-specific offices can transport youth to a juvenile-specific facility and no longer have them go through the adult intake at Coffee Creek. I think, as many of you have heard before, we have had a process where youth who are going to serve their sentence at the Oregon Youth Authority are transported from their place of detention in the county through the adult facility at Coffee Creek, because these are youth convicted as adults, usually under Measure 11. That process at Coffee Creek could last a week or more. The DOC, to their credit, through our now two-year-long negotiation process to get this resolved, has tried to shorten the amount of time that intake takes, but we know that any time that youth are in contact with adult prisoners, there's a risk to both their physical and mental health. So I'm very excited to hear that that we are all here today to support this bill. I think it really does come out of belief across agencies and based in the research that youth are harmed by any contact with the adult criminal justice system. And there has been particularly, I think, a commitment now by the local juvenile departments and Oregon Youth Authority to make sure that that doesn't happen in the future. So you'll see that all those folks, along with the Department of Corrections, have come together to work through this process. The sheriffs are not here, but have also submitted testimony in support, and Youth Rights and Justice intended to be here but stayed home due to the snow and also in support. And we want to thank Representative Barton very much for his commitment to this issue and for being willing to take one of his two bills for this session. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Christina McMahon. I am the Juvenile Services Division Director in Multnomah County. I am also the legislative chair for the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association, so I'm here to represent both entities today. I'll start with Multnomah County since my boss would appreciate that. I'm fortunate that I'm in a county that has resources where we are able to dedicate resources specifically to serve youth that have charges pending in the adult system. We have a designated unit in our detention center where we only house youth who are facing some sort of an adult charge. Right now, I checked our population this morning. We have 18 youth in that unit. We do special programming with those youth. We basically treat that as an opportunity to get them treatment ready to go to the Oregon Youth Authority so that hopefully their chances for availing themselves of the opportunities of the Oregon Youth Authority, that there's a much greater likelihood of success. As a county, a few years ago, we actually passed a county ordinance that required that all youth 16 and 17 were housed in our juvenile detention center and were not put in our jail unless there was some sort of safety issue or risk for staff. So we as a county have made a commitment to the policy choice of treating juveniles as juveniles, even those that are charged under the adult system. We feel that this is keeping with what's known as best practice, as Ms. White just said. The issue of major multiple transitions for youth. When they're sitting in our facility, they're in a specialized unit, staff that are trained who understand adolescent development and behavioral issues, and then they're sitting there and are wondering what is going to happen to them, how their life is going to be changed. It's a very anxiety-producing time for these young people. We are embarking on a big project to have trauma-informed practice infused in everything we do, including our work with youth who are in our detention facility. So the less transitions and changes in a short amount of time, the greater chance there will be that there are failures when they in behavioral incidents and staff at the Oregon Youth Authority or at DOC being put at risk because they're being treated in a way that reflects their development as adolescents. So we are strongly in favor of this. We are in the process of working out an agreement with our sheriffs department in Multnomah County so that as soon as this bill, hopefully, if it passes, we can go ahead and start doing what we need to do. So I just wanted to make it clear that we are very excited about this happening. As far as the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association goes, as I started out as saying, in Multnomah County, we're in a different position. We send a very large percentage of youth to the Oregon Youth Authority and DOC, actually, for under adult charges, the most in the state. About a third of the kids that are incarcerated on adult charges are from our county. So we have obviously a big stake in this. But other counties that are smaller have the same concerns and care about these issues, but they don't have the resources if they're way over in eastern Oregon counties to transport kids over to the valley. So the thing that the Oregon Juvenile Directors Association likes about this bill is that it is permissive. It allows collaboration. The Oregon Youth Authority, I don't want to speak for Mr. Cox, but the Oregon Youth Authority has worked out collaborations in some of those more rural areas. This bill, our association 100% unanimously, all of us agreed to support this because we felt that it allowed the flexibility for local practices and collaborations to be to remain, and there wasn't any kind of a mandate that could potentially have resource impacts for those smaller counties. So both Multnomah County and the OJDDA support the bill.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I am Marie Garcia. I'm the Legislative and Government Relations Manager for the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here on behalf of Assistant Director Kimbrough Camp. She couldn't make it due to the weather. However, sounds like the bill's been summarized pretty well for you. I'm here just to share that the department does support passage of House Bill 4037, and we feel it is for the greater good of the juvenile offenders. And it will help to facilitate sound correctional practices by allowing the direct transport of the juveniles.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Philip Cox, Assistant Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. Statute currently allows for sheriff departments to enter into agreements with the Department of Corrections to transfer young offenders directly from local jails and detention centers to the Oregon Youth Authority. This was a policy decision that was made by the legislature last session, and it was a good policy decision in a number of ways, and Ms. McMahon and Ms. White really spoke to them. First of all, it is really important to have a sight and sound separation between young juveniles, minors, and adult offenders. The policy change that occurred last session did that. It allowed for the transfer of kids or young people directly to an OYA facility. Secondly, when youth, it is really important for youth to be seen and dealt with people who are trained to deal and see young people. The Youth Authority obviously has people who are trained, and they do that every day. They see young people every day, they assess young people every day, and they provide services to young people every day. Thirdly, there are some efficiencies that can be made with the direct transfer to a youth authority facility. Firstly, many of the assessments that are done at the Department of Corrections at Coffee Creek have to be repeated at the youth authority. For example, physical assessments, mental health screenings, all of those sorts of things that first happen to an individual when they're going into an incarcerated setting have to be repeated at a different facility. And so we see this as certainly something that is one of government efficiency. And as Ms. McMahon stated, the movement of adolescents is a highly risky period of time for suicidality. And so the degree to which we can limit the number of movements, that's helpful. The Youth Authority sees this particular bill as one that adds flexibility within the public safety system. It allows for the sheriff's departments to enter into agreements with the youth authority or local juvenile departments to effect that transfer. We are in support of the bill. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Does anybody have any questions? Thank you, committee. Appreciate your panel. Appreciate your.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's go ahead and move this one. Well, it's close the public hearing. We expect to move this bill quickly when we have our members back from the snow days.
Do you have a quorum?
Yeah, we weren't going to move any bills. I don't say very much. Yeah. The next one. 4066. I have to open up 4143.
I'm going to 4098. We just need a land move to West Venice. So just kind of if you can get down to LC.
We have to look at 2 o'clock. I have another couple of minutes. I'm going to open another hearing first. Open a public hearing on House Bill 4143. Representative Reed, please. Sorry for the delay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like me to go ahead, or do you want to have a summary? Sometimes that's the way we do it in our committee. I don't want to cut anyone off.
Go ahead, please.
House Bill 4143 directs courts to order all unclaimed damages of a class action suit to be deposited in the Oregon Rainy Day Fund. It also authorizes courts to approve the process that is used in order to pay damages to the injured party.
Chair, committee members, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. During my freshman session, I had the privilege of serving on the Judiciary Committee with you, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, and Mr. Taylor. It's been some time, but I enjoyed that very much, and it's nice to be back before you. I'm here to describe House Bill 4143. It's not a new concept. In fact, it's one you've seen before. I don't want to waste your time describing class actions. You all know that better than me, so I want to describe just briefly what the bill does and what it doesn't. Our bill directs, as has been accurately described, that unclaimed dollars that remain at the end of a class action go to Oregon's Rainy Day Fund. Most of us have received a notice that we might be part of a class and that we might be owed money. Odds are that we threw that notice away. It's easy to mistake that as junk mail, and it's easy to decide that it's not worth the follow-up that is required. And for that reason, and because sometimes it's difficult to find people who are part of the class, most of the time less than 50% of the members of a class make their claim. Oregon and New Hampshire are the only states where those dollars that remain unclaimed are returned to the defendant. I want to be clear on some things that we're not changing. Class actions, as you well know, are closely supervised by the court. It's a court that decides the award, the attorneys, their fees, and many other aspects of the case. None of those things change as a result of this bill. You might wonder why we chose the Rainy Day Fund as a destination. There are a couple of important reasons I hope you'll keep in mind. One is unpredictability. We don't know what class actions might exist, what might come. We don't know the amounts that a court might award. We don't know the timing. So I think it's important that we avoid distributions that might create budget expectations. The other reason to keep in mind for the Rainy Day Fund is the difficulty of picking amongst the many programs and services that are underfunded in Oregon. As a member of the Revenue Committee, I spend a lot of time thinking about our revenue structure and our very small reserve funds. So it seems to me that this is really an important place. The fact that the Rainy Day Fund is available for the full range of activities in the state under objective criteria, I think that makes it a good place for unanticipated resources. I know there are other worthy places that those funds might go, and I'm open to those possibilities as well. But for me, the two keys are making sure that Oregon joins the 48 other states and ensure that the court's judgments are paid, and second, that we direct those dollars to a place that's appropriate given the unpredictable nature of the class actions. So I appreciate you hearing the bill, and I urge you to support it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Representative Reed? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Fred Boss, Michael Burdick, and Travis Prestwich, please.
I'm a special start. Chair Chair Barker, member of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I am Deputy Attorney General, and I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 4143. The Attorney General supports this bill. Under the rules of the court here in Oregon, in a class action lawsuit, if a class defendant is found liable, they are also found liable for a certain amount of money. It is then after that that individual claimants can claim money, and as the good representative testified, approximately between 50% and 60% of the time, people do not claim the money because it's a significantly a small amount or whatever reason. In our neighboring states, Washington, California, and Hawaii here on the West Coast, this residual amount is given to other causes. In California, it's allowed to be distributed to nonprofits. In Washington, it goes to pay for their legal aid. So this concept is as the representative testified, not unique. It happens in other states, and it is certainly a way of distributing money for the state into the rainy day fund. The Department of Justice had sponsored two other attempts at this bill, and this is our third time supporting this. We support it primarily we think, in all fairness, the funds in which a tortfeasor has been adjudicated liable should not go back to that tortfeasor. So we really we support it going to any place. There are many worthy causes, and so that would be that's our position.
Thank you. Ross.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Burdick with the State Treasurer's Office. The State Treasurer has written a letter in support of the bill. It's a short letter, and if you like, I can read it into the record. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 4143 brings Oregon in line with 48 other states in regard to the disposition of excess funds of class action judgments and settlements.
You don't need to read it. We'll put it in the record. So thank you very much. Appreciate and tell the Treasurer we appreciate his input.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Travis Prestwich. I appreciate you having me back again today. I currently serve on the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors, and I'm in private practice here in Salem. The bar's position on this particular legislation as written is neutral, but again, to support the comments that have been stated already, this is a proposal that has been before the legislature numerous times over the last decade and trying to find what to do with these funds. But as I testified yesterday, a worthy cause for these funds would be legal services in Oregon, especially considering the shortfall there and the intent that these, at least under the doctrine as understood, is that those funds are supposed to go to a charitable cause. So as far as the doctrine itself and not wanting to return those funds to the tortfeasor, the bar agrees with that principle.
Great, thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For any member of our panel, is there any sense of how many of these suits are handled in state court, how frequently these suits occur?
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, I've an anecdotal feeling from the Department of Justice that they're not frequent, but they do happen. In preparation for my testimony here, I had my support staff try and check through OGIN, and we could not find through the OGIN system how class actions were broken out. So I can't testify to an exact number.
Thank you.
So follow up on that, Mark. My sense, Ms. Ross, just following up, I have absolutely no idea. I don't practice class action. I don't know much about them, but it seems to me that the vast majority of them, I think, are in federal court and would not be affected by this bill. This would be the relatively few number, I think, that appear in state court. Is that correct?
Chair Barker, Representative Barton, it's hard to tell. There are significant class action lawsuits, and primarily, say, securities actions and that type of thing in our federal courts. Our consumer protection advocates see class actions in state court, and I can't, because I wasn't able to get out the material out of OGIN, I couldn't really do a compare and contrast.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
Mr. Dewey, Mr. Wilson, please.
Good
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, representing the Oregon Tort Reform Liability Coalition. I was wondering why I thought Oregon and New Hampshire thought a lot alike, and now I know. So this bill, our firm started representing the coalition in 2013, so I've, in the last couple days, tried to become somewhat of an expert in the class action arena, in by no means will be or are at this point in time. We would argue first, and then I'll get into some other more substantive arguments, that this is a bill that, and you're going to hear this a million times, but I think it is appropriate here, is best served for a regular session. And I say that because, in part, when we look at the statute, we've so far, in terms of the testimony, focused on the money that is unclaimed. And I would agree a large percentage is unclaimed in a class action lawsuit. I've seen the offers, I remember one on an airlines ticket where I'd get a $100 refund, but it was on a regular ticket, for example, and that was $500, and I could go online and get a $300 ticket. So I get that there are there's money left over in the pot. What I want to focus on is the nexus as to where the money should go, and is it appropriate to go to the rainy day fund? That's popular. I get that. Is it legal aid? In many ways, in the settlement, should they decide where that goes? Should the court decide where it goes? And sometimes there's some conflicts there. But is the rainy day fund the right place? Probably we need more time to have that discussion. So the system has worked in terms of class actions and how they work for at least 40 years. And one of the things I want to focus on here is we are extinguishing in the statute the form, and the form will be at the discretion of the court in terms of how the class is developed. And so I ask you to take a look at that because in part, for example, in subsection F3, you have the ability to go it alone if you choose to. That's extinguished. So I don't know if that's good public policy or not, but that's something that you might want to look at. Might the court have difficulty establishing the class, try and get a settlement, and none of the money, this might be impractical, I don't know, because the form is gone. Might there be a way where there is no money distributed to the class, the money ends up in the hands of the rainy day fund, legal aid, or wherever? So that's something that could occur. Under current law, the statute says the on the form it must specify or describe the members. The statute is being modified to generally describe the members. So it seems to me that we're changing how the class would be developed again. The issue then is by changing the statute in terms of the unclaimed, might there be more lawsuits? I don't know that. There might be an incentive because attorney fees arguably are going to be higher under the new mechanism. So I think these questions, at least in my mind, bring you hopefully to a discussion of if we're going to do this in 2015, and we're happy to sit down and talk about perhaps how to do that. So that's what I have for you. Thank you.
Thanks, yeah. Mr. Dewey, is this bill significantly different than the ones that have been introduced in the past? I'm a freshman. I know this has been around for 10 or 20 years in this building. And other than where the money goes, is it significantly different?
Mr. Chair and Representative Williamson, we did not have a bill in 2013, and so I just started working on these issues in 2013. So I haven't looked at the legislation in 2011. I haven't looked at what was said at that point in time. Those bills didn't move forward. I don't know why, but I'd have to look at that to see if it's any different. And I'm happy to look at at least the 2011 legislation.
Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Barker and members. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing Associated Oregon Industries. We wouldn't support House Bill 4143 as it is written today. If this was just about disposition of overages and where that money should go, I think we could have a pretty constructive conversation with the proponents. I think what we object to is there's been 40 years of statute on how you constitute a class. It's been a rational process. I don't know that there's been any, it's there to protect defendants. The class is constituted by people who file for the class. They assert a certain amount of damages. You basically, it's the total award is the sum of all the people who filed, so you have a rational basis for the damages that are awarded. Again, if this was an issue about disposition of money that's not paid out, I think we would have a good conversation and maybe come to some agreement with the proponents. But we're talking about letting, changing how you arrive at that number and what constitutes the class. And to our knowledge, it's a process that served us pretty well for 40 years, and we don't have any indication that it's broken or any desire to change it. And so that's the basis of our opposition to the bill as it's written. Again, with regard to the disposition of overages, I think that is a conversation worth having. I just don't want to throw out the process to get there.
Thank you. Representative Martin.
A question for either or both of you. I appreciate your constructive way in which you're approaching this. It sounds to me, and I don't want to, but it sounds like neither of you guys have, you guys both agree generally with the concept that a tortfeasor should not benefit from the overages. I think you said disposition of overages, also called the CPRE doctrine. You guys are okay with that in concept. Is that fair?
Thank you, Chair Barker and Representative Burton. I mean, I don't think we have a tremendous difficulty with that. I think that the danger that I see, mm-hmm. we see, is how you constitute the claim. Now the court can bypass this process and make judgments about the nature of the class generally. I think it would have the effect of inflating awards anyways. And I think that there's a real danger in that. So if we're talking about dispositions of funds that we have arrived at on a rational basis that's in place today, again, I think we could have a constructive conversation about where that goes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Martin, we quite frankly haven't had that conversation. Mm-hmm. AOI is a member of our group, but we haven't gotten to that, in part because it's a short session. You know, you could argue we had plenty of time to look at it, mm-hmm. and I respect where Representative Reed's coming from. But we just haven't had that conversation, so I can't say a yes or no to that at this point.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 4143. Open a public hearing on, I'll open a work session real quick on House Bill 4098.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 4098, I believe some amendments will be passed out if they have not already been done so. Two, threes, and fours. The bill as originally written requires the Department of Corrections to include time spent in jail awaiting trial for persons convicted of offenses or related offenses. Also, the second part of the issue includes within the provisions of exclusions from information to the defendant's attorney or where he's prohibited from giving to his client email addresses and cell text message and numbers, Mr. Chairman. We asked Jessica Minifee to come up and explain these amendments. She's outside chatting. Oh, excuse me. She's because we just recently received them, and I understand Representative Hicks would like to have this bill go to Ways and Means Committee, and I had a call from the Speaker's staff this morning saying that was okay.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm just here to explain the three amendments, okay. The dash twos, dash threes, and dash fours. Jessica Minifee from Legislative Council. The dash twos are a slight modification where I added an applicability provision, so it's very clear what the changes in credit for time served calculations are applied to. anything having to do with the sentence itself is going to be applying to sentencing proceedings on or after the effective date. And anything regarding probation and a revocation of probation and what credit for time served you get for that is going to be for probation revocation proceedings on or after the effective date. And because I moved the applicability provision to the end, I had to change around a little bit the substance of the bill itself because there was a slight applicability provision within one of them. The second thing that it does is it addresses a problem that Doug Hockelrode talked about at the public hearing where somebody who is presumptive probation and gets sanctioned over and over for violations and then is ultimately revoked, because the judge can't deny credit for time served, there may be no additional time left if that other bill passes, limiting the revocation sentence. So essentially, the person gets revoked and wouldn't have any additional jail. So this creates sort of a bifurcated process where if the person is presumptive probation, the judge can deny credit for time served, so it keeps the current law. So if for some reason the person has used up all of their credits, the judge could deny them and they would get a revocation sentence of some length. But if you are a downward departure, meaning you're presumptive prison under the guidelines and you received a downward departure to probation, the judge cannot deny credit for time served. Those are the people that are going to the Department of Corrections when they're revoked. So in that case, they would receive all the credit for time served for the sanctions they've received when they go to the Department of Corrections. So those are the dash twos, if there are any questions.
I thought a person would not get credit for their sanctions when they went to prison.
Well, this would allow them to get the credit for time served for the specific.
Representative.
Sorry.
Yes. So when the person is revoked but not going to prison, then this does not assign credit for time served for the sanctions that they served during the probationary period, but it will assign credit for time served if they're actually going up the river, so to speak.
Okay, so but the sanctions, so they've been penalized because they keep screwing up, and
yes.
Then we're going to give them credit for that time?
Only if they go to the Department of Corrections for the full 13-plus months.
Okay.
So if they're not in the custody of the department, yes.
Okay.
Yes or no?
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, yes.
Yeah.
It kind of half solves the issue. So some of those people are still going to get the credits if they're going to the Department of Corrections, but
okay.
The people who are presumptive probation and would have just served the 60-day sentence would not get those credits if the judge chose to deny them.
I hope we got this right. It's a good idea. I just hope we got it right.
Okay. Well, it's only going one of ways and means.
We'll do one at a time, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, we're in work session. We're in work session, so the dash twos we just heard about. Is there any discussion?
I'll move the dash twos.
Okay,
if you're looking for that motion.
Representative Barton moves the dash twos. Is there any objection? I'm one objection, but. I am an objection, but we can move on.
We can do it another day.
I'd love to hear your comments.
This is going back some 50 years. If you're in the Marine Corps, you go into brig, that doesn't count on your enlistment. If you're in a brig for a month and you had a four-year enlistment, you do 4 years in 1 month. You don't get credit for bad time, for bad acting that detracts from it. Mm-hmm. If somebody is on probation and commits whatever violations or crimes, it gets these sanctions, I don't think they should get credit for those because that's like a separate, to me, that's a separate punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't like to see them get credit for that.
Mr. Chair, if I may ask a follow-up, I'm not even setting aside the substance of that argument, which seems fair to me. The motion was on the dash two amendments, which seemed to make the bill better, and you're talking about the overall bill. Are we objecting to even the amendment?
No, I'm objecting to that portion of that amendment.
Gotcha.
So.
Gotcha.
We don't have to move it in, then we can do it.
And we do have
you have five votes.
Yeah, you have a quorum.
Yeah.
You have a quorum.
Okay.
You have a quorum, and you have a majority.
To five people, right.
Because we have nine members.
So as long as there's no other objections, we'll go ahead and move it.
Okay.
I'll just be the one, like a no vote on that particular.
Just on the amendment.
Just on the one amendment.
Gotcha.
Okay. Amendment. two is it.
U3. Explain 3RA.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you have the dash threes? Sure. The dash threes are, both the dash threes and the dash fours are addressing House Bill 3194, the public safety bill from last year. It's my understanding that the purpose last year in that bill was to take marijuana and marijuana product out of the commercial drug offense completely. And so the amounts of marijuana in that statute were taken out. However, there's more than one way to charge a commercial drug offense, and you can also charge it with any possession, delivery, or manufacture of a controlled substance, which marijuana still is, with three of the factors that may not include the actual quantities of the drug. So this changes that to completely take marijuana out of the commercial drug offense statute so that it can no longer be charged as a commercial drug offense, the possession, manufacture, or delivery. And I did that by just specifying that it has to be a controlled substance other than marijuana or marijuana product. So those are the dash threes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash three amendments into House Bill 4098.
Representative Barton moves the dash three into House Bill 4098. Are there any objections to that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we haven't even heard about this until now, right? Have we discussed this?
We discussed it last year in the 3194 that we're taking the marijuana out of that.
The cleanup of that.
Yeah, this is the cleanup of that piece.
Do we have anybody here that was on?
No, he's on the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd say Prinz and Harkelrode are out there nodding their heads.
Okay.
Chair Barker, we do actually have Jim Callahan, who was president of the DA's Association, and sat in on all these negotiations.
If he'd like to come up,
yeah, that'd be great.
You can come up too if you want.
Good afternoon. Yes, I'm Tim Colahan. I was president of the District Attorneys Association in 2013. Rod Underhill, Multnomah County DA, and myself were involved in the negotiations regarding 3194. We actually did have a conversation about this very issue yesterday with the governor's office. And our intent was, and the negotiations did, in fact, involve taking marijuana out as a presumptive prison sentence in those cases. I think it was an oversight, and we did in not making sure that the commercial drug offense language was also included in that, because looking back through our notes, looking back in the information that we generated as part of the negotiations, that in fact was the intent.
Okay, thank you.
So we have a motion on the table to adopt the dash threes. Yeah. I'm okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Dash fours.
The dash fours are also addressing something from House Bill 3194 from last year. That bill, prior to that bill, only the judge could order special conditions of probation when sentencing a defendant. And 3194 created a process where a probation officer can do a risk assessment and modify the special conditions of probation and then file notice with the court and the probationer and the DA that they're doing that. I think the thought was that usually the PO would be removing conditions, and they gave there's a procedure where the district attorney can object to the modification of probation conditions. But I don't think, well, maybe people didn't think about people or the PO adding a condition where the probationer would want to object. And clearly that would be a due process violation without there being some procedure where the probationer could object to an additional condition. So this creates a system where the district attorney, the probationer, or the court can all object to these changes in the special conditions of probation. It extends the deadline a little bit to 10 days, so they have 10 days to object. And then it also requires the PO to give a copy of the probation modification to the defense attorney on the underlying case if it's within a short period of time. And the idea was that potentially you could just retain that same appointed attorney who could, you know, intervene on the probationer's behalf, and you may not need to appoint a new attorney for the hearing.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this issue was first brought to our attention by Representative Olson whose judges at Lynn County raised the issue with him over due process. That's why it's before us.
Thank you. Okay, we have the dash.
I'll move the dash four amendments to 1498.
Barton moves the dash fours in the House Bill 4098. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it goes in. I'll make a motion to move it to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4098 as amended to Ways and Means.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 4098 as amended to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
What a coincidence.
Oh, okay. With due pass. Not bad.
Is that what we want?
It'll say due pass.
Any objection? Hearing none, sword and down it goes. Boom. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4066. Bill Lemming and Travis, again, Prestwich, please.
You never know.
Yeah. Alex, could you give a summary, please? Thank you, Bill.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 4066 will authorize the Chief Justice to set reasonable fees for access to data from electronic case management systems, collectively known as Oregon Judicial Case Information Network, with an additional provision requiring the Chief Justice to give prior notice of any changes to fees under the network, along with reasonable time for comment on fee decisions prior to implementation. House Bill 4066 will also repeal the sunset provisions on the increase of statutory filing fees that are set to go into effect June 30th, 2014.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Phil Lemon from the State Court Administrator's Office. I want to briefly describe what's in the bill and how we got to that place where we are here and some of the reasons for it. As you know, the state courts are moving from a 30-year-old legacy case management system called OGIN, the Oregon Judicial Information Network, to new systems in both the appellate and the state trial courts. And so we have separate names for each of those systems, but collectively we are calling them the Oregon Judicial Case Information Network, as counsel just said. So what we're trying to do is take the authority that the Chief Justice now has to establish fees for OGIN, one of those systems, and carry that over so he has similar authority for all those systems. So that's why we get to the Oregon Judicial Case Information Network. So the first piece of this bill in Section 1 is to clarify that the Chief Justice does have specific statutory authority to establish fees for all three of those electronic systems. And working with stakeholders, we have modified the bill as it was introduced last session, so the Chief Justice the fees would be reasonable. They would be reasonably calculated to recover or offset court technology costs. The Chief Justice would provide notice to interested persons and an opportunity to comment before adopting or increasing any fee, and that the Chief Justice would use a Chief Justice order to flesh out what the specific notice and comment requirements would be. And then under the legislation that was adopted by this body last in the 2013 session, all of those fees would be statutorily dedicated to support court technology purposes, so they could not be used for general court operations. The other piece in this is that as part of moving to the e-court system, we have what we call a file and serve application, so parties can electronically file pleadings with the court, and they would be electronically served on other parties to the case. We had proposed a specific user fee to support that service, so every time a litigant used the file and serve system, they would have a transaction fee. In working with the stakeholders, they preferred a broader funding approach, and so the stakeholders and this assembly agreed to enact increases to the statutory filing fees to pay for that file and serve service. So the litigants pay once up front, and then the transaction fee that is due to the vendor by contract is paid by the Judicial Department through an appropriation from those filing fees. The legislature made those filing fee increases temporary to allow us to look at that system, make sure it's working as we plan, and see if there's any different or better way of doing it. We've all taken a look at that and bringing it back to you with a recommendation that you remove the sunset on those filing fee increases and make it a permanent situation where those filing fees will be used to support the file and serve service in the future. So that's a general overview of the two pieces. I would just add, to put on the record, a couple questions that have come up. We've had questions from district attorney offices and the Department of Justice on whether they would be charged for access to these new services and for document access in the future. The answer to that is no, that they, the Chief Justice will continue his current policy of not charging public bodies who are exempt for the OGIN services and continue that forward. We have had some questions about criminal defense attorneys and public defend people, attorneys who are contracted to do public defense. Again, we're continuing the status quo, whereas if 50% or more of your practice is in court-appointed cases, you would have free access not just to the OJCIN system but to document access. If your practice is less than 50%, then you would continue to be charged for that. The other question is whether attorneys of record in a case would be charged for online access to documents filed in that case. The answer to that is a little, it's not a straight yes or no. When a document is filed using that file and serve service, it remains there, and anybody who is a party in that case can access it, whether it's a document that they e-filed or a document that was e-filed in that case. If a party to that case or another document was not filed using file and serve, then it would not be available free of charge to them. And so as we move toward a mandatory system where everybody has to e-file, then that distinction will disappear, we hope. But proposed orders from the courts and documents that are not electronically filed using the file and serve service would not be available. Otherwise, they would be available and at no charge.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Again, Travis Presswich on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. The Bar has worked diligently with the Oregon Judicial Department in setting up and establishing the e-court system, and as part of that, the e-fees component to that. We're confident that the Bar and other stakeholders who have an interest will continue to be able to do that and recognize that as Oregon's courts move to an electronic tracking system and filing system, that it's important for the court system to be able to collect data so as to know what fees to charge. And so for that reason, we're supportive, but also recognizing that it's important that as part of this process that that there is access to justice, that the fees be established in a fair manner, and that, that fee structure be transparent to all interested parties. So, and I'll answer any questions I can.
Okay, any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank all the stakeholders who have spent lots of hours working through very technical, difficult issues around fees as we move to e-court. And I just want to urge this committee to be flexible as we move through this implementation, because we don't know all the issues that are going to come up yet. And we are working really hard to guess how things are going to work and to work with our vendors and our stakeholders. But we may have other issues, and they may come before this court, before this committee. And so I'm really thankful that the stakeholders have stayed at the table and worked through a lot of these things, but we may have more to come.
Okay, and this bill looks like it's ready to go to Ways and Means. I think, although we weren't going to move bills today, I think we will move this one now.
That would be
great. Because we've got to get things lined up down there. As you know, time's going to fly here. So I'll close the public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 4066.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4066 to the Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 4066 to Ways and Means with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Thank you.
Any further business to come before the committee today? Seeing none, good travel, safe travels home. Adjourned. Adjourned. Safe travels home.